You're listening to Soundbite, a podcast from Deeper Than Blue. So we're here at the Deeper Than Blue offices in Sheffield. I'm Stephen Birch, Marketing Manager, and we're here with Neil Murphy,
Senior Business Architect, Deeper Than Blue.
And Chris Booker.
So I'm Sales and Marketing Director, Deeper Than Blue.
So we're gathered around the table to have a chat about AI for business. So we've been delivering a number of webinars recently to demystify some of the details of AI and look at some practical applications. Chris, why have we decided to do this here and now?
Well, I think AI has come a long way in the last couple of years since the release or recognition of generative AI, which is moving on from what we classify as older AI, which has been in existence for 10 to 20 years and actually goes back a lot further than that to the 1950s.
Okay, so Neil, do you want to step in there and say a little bit about where AI is now?
Yeah, I think that one of the reasons for putting the webinars together was, yes, there's lots of excitement, there's lots of news in the media around AI, it's everywhere you look at the moment, but increasingly I think people were getting to the point where there's a certain amount of frustration in terms of, yeah, it's everywhere, everybody's talking about it, but so what? You know, what do I actually, how do I actually put this to use? Where, how do I get some?
Who's doing it for real?
Yeah, who's doing it for real? Yeah, so, I mean, on one hand, you seem to have people where there's a whole fear of missing out. So, lots of talk about AI in the media for all kinds of reasons, and some companies and some people within organizations are thinking, is this a threat? Is it an opportunity? Are we missing out? Are other people doing more around this than we are? And then I think there's also a large percentage of the population thinking, God, you know, I'm just sick of hearing this. You know, there's just so much noise and so much fuss around this. But in the middle, yeah, it's how do we get some practical value from this, and where do I start?
And that's the key. You talked about demystifying AI for people, and we put this series of webinars together, AI for Business. Eventually, we're going to build that into a network and a forum where people come face to face. That's the concept and the idea behind this. And we really want to show people how you can use AI from a practical business perspective. And a lot of the use cases that you've heard about today have probably been aimed at the office space, the white collar area for AI. But as we travel through and demonstrate some of the proof of concepts and projects we've been working on, some of those are actually in the blue-collar areas where we may be operating in the warehouse, we may be operating out on the street, in the public environment, as well as a number of other settings.
So a lot of people have their own ideas of what AI is.
Yep.
Maybe we could have a look at that a bit further.
Okay. It's all over the media. Lots of people are talking about these kind of things. And a lot of the examples that you see in the media tend to fall into that kind of cool or controversial or creepy pieces. They're quite entertaining. They're interesting to look at, you know, and they generate quite a lot of hype. But also what's not helping is that lots of things that we used to call maybe machine learning, maybe before that getting into, deep learning, everything's been lumped together now under these categories. So what we used to call machine learning, I think we've seen called now predictive AI. What Chris referred to there in terms of the sort of older school pieces where we used to have a traditional AI is a discriminative AI, really, where we've got a group of information, a lot of data, and we look to label that data so that we can identify boundaries and classify information that falls inside and without outside that. So that's the kind of traditional, I think, in one of the webinars, I've got cats and dogs and being able to discriminate between the two.
You know? So people are doing that online, aren't they?
Absolutely.
They're being trained or helping Google train. When you see a block of images,
yeah,
they're helping Google train what is a cat or a dog.
Yeah, so that's where we've taken a usually when you're doing that kind of work, you're starting with a known outcome. This is our purpose. This is what we're trying to build a model to do.
Yeah.
We take a set of source data, training data, in order to train the model in order to do that. And then we build something that's specific for that use case. When we get into generative AI, into the new pieces, quite often we're using models that have got multiple use cases, and it doesn't work in slightly the same way. So I think when we talk about generative AI, it's where we're creating new content, we're generating new content.
Yeah.
And that's the differentiator, and that's really what's been responsible for all of the hype. And actually is creating some real opportunities in terms of generating value.
We're also working with not just structured data, which you could argue that's an element of AI in the past and machine learning, but we're also working with unstructured data, so text, media, in terms of images, videos, and a range of other pieces of content that users and applications can interact with that weren't previously accessible.
So you refer there to data, images, video, different modes of data.
Yeah, I mean, more recently you start to see some of the large language models that underpin all of these things called multimodal. So that could be not just data and text, which is where a lot of this stuff started, but also images, video, sound, etc., speech, all of those things. So you tend to get multimodal models now, and that's becoming more and more prevalent. So in terms of the overall pieces, the generative stuff, people are using ChatGPT. They're using, and that's where a lot of the hype started, I think.
That's the starting point, isn't exactly. It, for a lot of people, is a tool like ChatGPT, maybe Copilot if they're in a...
Yeah, or Gemini if you're in that, in those other. But what's been interesting there is to see how, talking about the multimodal pieces, how they've progressed from, I can add some text, I can ask some questions, I can generate a prompt, and I can do some stuff that's text-related. Quickly then it's, can you generate me an image that represents this, or I can actually talk to the model and have that interpret that in multiple ways. And actually, when you get into a lot of the video stuff, I think this is one of the areas that catches the eye, doesn't it, in terms of a lot of the online media pieces, those creepy images that
you... Well, you touched on that earlier, didn't you?
Yeah.
Mentioned creepy.
So yeah.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, when you...
An example.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff that you see, a lot of the things that we see around deepfake.
Yes.
Right, where you... And again, when we've got into the recent political pieces, there's been lots of pieces around that, where you can either take a real image or a real piece of video and overlay that with speech or voice or other pieces, sure. Or vice versa. There's some interesting pieces where you can take an audio clip and then take a still image and marry those two things together.
Yeah.
And these are getting better and better. I mean, increasingly, it's quite difficult to see the joint, whereas in the earlier days...
It's obvious, isn't it?
It was quite obvious, yeah. and still sometimes there's something not quite natural.
You can notice it with their eyes in terms of their movements, and just not quite.
Yeah, they don't quite align. However... Yeah, that's getting better and better.
It's the speed with which this is happening.
Yeah,
is phenomenal.
If you
think that ChatGPT first came out when,
back end of 2022, sort of late October, November when it launched. So back in previous guises, but we're now circa 2 years.
2 years, and it's
evolved considerably
in
the number of updates. And I think this is an interesting point, isn't it? In that not just OpenAI with ChatGPT, but we almost saw an arms race during 2023 into 2024. With if it wasn't ChatGPT, then it was Google with Bard, which was the forerunner to Gemini in terms of releases and updates. Mm. And obviously they rebranded Bard at the start of this year in terms of 2024 to Gemini and their Vertex platform underpinning that. But we saw other models in terms of Claude.
Yeah, before you get into any more of this though, when we were doing the original webinars, a couple of things that, well, first of all, it's interesting how we very quickly start talking about deepfake and video uses, because again, there are a lot of the things that catch a lot of attention.
True.
There are not too many, I mean, obviously there are lots of exceptions, but not too many businesses for whom that really fits in with their business model. And if we're, our webinar series was all about, you know, how can you get value from this very
quickly? Practical use of AI.
Yeah. So in some respects, that stuff is really clever. We all like to talk about it, but it's a real distraction. And what we want to do is focus on things where you can actually get some value in the short term.
So finding use cases or problem areas of your business where this could be applied.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the second bit, again, we're working with this stuff all the time, right? So it's very easy to get into discussing some of the language around it, some of the terms, and something else we tried to overcome in the webinars was really just to provide a bit of a cheat sheet.
Yeah.
You know, some of the common terminology that people might need to know really, if they're going to get into these kind of conversations either with people like us or with vendors or with other people internally, so that you're not blinded with science, and there's just some pieces that you really need to
cover up. Baseline effectively.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about generative AI, and again, you can if you stick with the thought that generative AI is about creating new content of some description, right? Anything that didn't exist beforehand, and it's easy to position that when you understand that what came before it. But for some people, that may be a little bit more difficult. So again, the discriminative AI stuff is where you're using it to sort of classify data and answer specific questions. You're training a model based on existing pieces. But there are some similarities. So you'll hear people talk about foundation models, which are the sort of underlying data structure. You might need to understand that, but possibly not. But large language models is the thing that people talk about all the time. You mentioned arms race.
Yes.
And how some of the vendors are competing in terms of, you know, our models being
the models, the names from different vendors. There.
Yeah. So again, you know, when we look at the sort of GPT model and the size and the scope of those things, initially there was lots of discussion about the number of parameters that were used in order to train and create those things, and I think we actually got to the point where people stopped publishing that now in terms of the size and the underlying data. But
there are model cards, aren't there, for people to review?
There are places to go in order to do comparisons. But again, in terms of that, what a large language model is, it's the kind of smart intermediary that can provide that human-like interaction between yourself and that underlying data model.
Yes.
So when people talk about those things, large language models, there are different flavors, there are different models of different sizes.
Have they been trained on different data sets?
Yeah, generally. If you look at the arms race that we talked about there, again, the larger models trained on vast, massive amounts of underlying. It'd be good if I could quote some actual numbers.
Terabytes of data, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of those.
Maybe even petabytes.
Yeah.
Of data.
Yeah, so it's not always a case, though, that a large language model is the bigger the better.
No.
And quite often, actually, when you get into some of the discussions that come up in our meetings, that's you kind of want to avoid using all of those things in those. But it really comes down to the use case.
Yeah, so it's not always the most accurate. It's not always the most cost-effective either, is it? Because you don't need the largest language model for every particular use case.
So just looking at some of the cheat sheet terms that we went through in that first webinar, we talked about foundation models and that they're the thing, the underlying data structures that you don't necessarily interact with directly. More importantly, really, is to understand large language models and the capability that they provide, really. So that's the they're the bit that provide that kind of smart intermediary.
Sure.
The bit that you that means that you can have a human-like interaction.
And how many large language models are there?
Well, there are hundreds,
right.
Thousands. I mean, you can build your own, or you can go back to one of the key core vendors.
Okay.
And actually, last year you talked about Andres earlier on, that there was a there seemed to be a new one coming out every week that was bigger and better than the previous one.
Yeah.
That was, you know, using the power of a small country to generate. And in some cases, if you think about things like ChatGPT, that's a big, large language model that's being put out there for multiple users to ask just about anything. So it's pointed at various bits of the internet, it's pointed at massive amounts of data sources, and that's used in order to train that underlying model.
The data pile.
Yeah, absolutely. So that you can then go and ask it all kinds of questions.
Yep.
It doesn't know what you're going to ask, so it basically has to get a very wide set of data in order to answer any kind of question you might come up with.
Yeah.
But ChatGPT comes in different flavors, doesn't it?
Well, what you find actually there is that if you go from the free version to the paid version, they allow you to interact with a different GPT model.
Yes.
So if you want the latest and greatest model and you want to ask lots of questions about over there, then typically you have to pay a little bit more. But that again, is an example of a kind of a broad generic model that's going to be set at a point in time that would allow you to ask just about anything. On the other hand, if a different use case might be, we've only got a set number of questions, or we want to ask questions that are just about set. There's a very small subset of
FAQs on your website that are constantly asked.
Yeah, or some of your own internal data. So at that point, you really don't need something that knows all about everything that's about on the internet. You just need something that's small and domain specific that fits in that point. So that's why I think we've got this whole series of large language models that are out there.
Yeah.
They're not all large,
no.
But they're all trained on different data sets. So part of the trick is, I think, understanding which one fits.
And you mentioned earlier there that they're trained up until a certain date.
Yeah.
So can you elaborate on that in terms of...
Yeah, so when the kind of training process is going on, they're generally there's a cutoff point. So if you're asking questions of a specific large language model, the responses you get will be based on the currency of the training data upon which the model was originally built.
So if you're asking something about a football result this weekend,
yeah,
that's not going to be in the model, is it?
It won't be in the model at that point in terms of how that thing was trained.
So
now,
how would we do that today then?
All right, so that doesn't necessarily mean that it won't come up with a decent answer, but it might come up with an answer, it might be what you want. So what you're looking at there is that you've got the underlying capability, but that doesn't mean that the data that it uses to give you a response is limited to what was originally in the training data.
Okay. Yeah.
So you can augment you can pass some additional data to the model, or you can give it a few nudges to say, this is the kind of response I'm looking for, and here's where you might go and find the answer. So, for example, you might go, it's a football, I want to know the how much football results. I might want to know
a score for a particular match.
As part of the request, I can structure the request to say, I'm looking for the result of this. I need it for this particular reason. This is the format I would like it. Go and check these particular places in order to get that information.
Sources of information.
Yeah. So you're still using the underlying model in order to provide the human-like interaction that you're looking for.
And understand the intent.
Yeah. But you're then augmenting that with additional data in order to structure the result.
And what do we call that? What's that process?
Well, the process of actually asking questions is what we call prompting.
Yes.
And then the process of coming up with the right way in order to ask the questions, we call prompt engineering. It's not really that technical. It's a bit more trial and error. It takes a bit of practice. But it's really just about a matter of understanding how the data is being, how the model itself performs.
Mm-hmm.
Some models are better at answering questions like that and doing that human piece and dealing with chat. others are better at sifting through large back catalogues of information, summarising and drawing those other components. So again, understanding the strengths and weaknesses and then tuning your prompts to meet the strengths of the appropriate models.
And when we go out to those third-party sources of information, so it could be a website, a football site, like the Premier League, or the Championship, that process of making that request from the model to the site, gaining that information and then bringing that data back and presenting it to the user, how do we define that? What's going off there in terms of how that's talking and speaking to that particular third-party site? So we spoke earlier about an example where we're using a large language model, whether it be ChatGPT, Gemini, Copilot, or another one, to interact and find information. We use the analogy of football results, a particular team, and how we might be interested in understanding, even though our model's been trained on a data pile, a set of data to a certain date, so it could be up until last month, but we're now interested in what the result is for this weekend, when the Premier League's playing. How does the model go and make that request to get that data from a third-party source? And then once it gets the response, how is it compiling and presenting that back to the user, albeit at light speed? How is it doing it in terms of the conversation it has with the third-party source? What do we call that process and how the model is interacting?
So in terms of the, if you want the model to answer a question based on data that wasn't in the original training set, you need to point it in other directions. Either some of the tools will do that on their own, right? They'll go off and look for it. So if you're using Copilot, which is based on an underlying large language model, the Copilot bit will maybe go and point it at various places in the internet in order to answer some of those questions for you.
Sure.
However, if you want to have an answer based on some of your own information, you can provide that at the same time as the request.
So that could be an internal application system or even a third-party source.
Could be as simple as a PDF file.
Right.
That you give it a PDF file and say, based on this document, answer me this question or tell me, or summarize this or tell me that information, something about that. Or it could be it's going to point at one of your back-end enterprise systems and go and look at the latest status of a particular customer and come back with all those. Just about anything, right?
So it can be requesting an API.
And
it'll give you custom information.
Exactly. And that's called, that process is called RAG, Retrieval Augmented Generation. You're going to get additional information in order. Now, there are other ways of going about this. You can get into something called fine tuning, which is where you go and you take the large language model as it was originally built and you train it with an additional data set that you might provide.
So you're creating a private instance there.
You are. And that generally means you get into some additional costs and complexity. So yes, you can absolutely do that. And lots of organizations might do that. And you can probably do that as well if you're hosting this thing internally, you know, if you're doing those pieces. But you start to get expensive when you're around that.
So just on that point, we've named and talked about a few public models. Everybody can recognize ChatGPT from OpenAI. We touched on Gemini, Microsoft Copilot. These are running the public cloud as a rule, these models. Can I run a model locally, on-premise, or in my own data center?
Yeah, you can run your own. You can host the models locally. You can host models on your own laptop if you want to, and the and the use case is appropriate in order to do that. So
right, so it doesn't always matter.
No, it's really down to choosing the right hosting model, and again in terms of what kind of resources you've got available to you. Also, you know, things like the privacy of the data and how restrictive you want to be around that.
Well, that's an important subject matter, isn't it, for organisations, in that the last thing you want is your corporate financial or confidential information being trained into a model and that will then eventually become public.
Yeah, I mean, when we get into discussions with people, and we typically, one of the big three that come up, right? So again, this is Yorkshire, so it always happens. how much is all this going to cost?
Yeah.
People want to know, right? So, and then as we touched on there, how you host it, what you're using it for, what your use case is going to impact all those things. We can get into some of those pieces of notes. The second thing that people want to know is, what's happening to my data? Where's my data going? It's one thing using a large language model that's hosted somewhere else, but I don't want I may not want my data or my
confidential,
or maybe not even just the data. I might not even want the prompts or the exchanges that I have made to be used in order to train that model.
Okay.
It might be so confidential that I don't want any of that information to be out there. So I need to be assured that that's not actually going to happen. And different hosting models have an impact on that. Different vendors also make kind of a big play around how safe and secure your data is and how it's actually being put to use. So
we're working with a number of vendors at the moment where effectively they specialise and they emphasise that your data is safe and that it's not being used to train future models.
Yeah.
And they create effectively a private instance for you in terms of a walled garden, so it is secure.
Yeah, I mean, some of the like you say, there's lots of terms and conditions around how data is being put to use. I'd say read the small print, make sure you've ticked all the right boxes about what's being shared and what's not. And if you need to use a publicly hosted service, it's still possible to have that locked down and fit within the same security model as everything else. Look, how many people are using cloud services for other things? Yeah, you could argue that is actually data leaving your organization, but it's done so in such a controlled way that it's not seen as any kind of security breach.
No.
And use of these models falls into a very similar category. On the other hand, you might not really care. You might really just be in a situation.
Some use cases might not matter.
Exactly. Right. So again, how you host it, where you host it, what kind of model choice you make,
is
consideration down to that use case.
Neil, you talk about data coming from anywhere on the internet, potentially.
Yeah.
How can you be confident that the answer you get is right?
Yeah, it's a good point. Hallucination is the technical term allocated. BS, I think, is what the Americans might kind of abbreviate it to. It generally, the really worrying thing is when something sounds really convincing. The response comes back. You're using one of these large language models. It's putting in terms that sound believable. And a lot of that comes back to what we talked about prompt engineering, about how you go and ask the questions. But there are also other settings in there in terms of how creative you allow the model to be. And so again, in some use cases, you might want things to be kind of creative. In others, if you're auditing somebody's accounts, probably not, right? You want those things to be absolutely. And if you don't know, tell us you don't know. And also tell us what the data is actually based on. So,
models can hallucinate, come on, and they can be quite convincing when they do.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that you need to look at is a number of the models will come back with the source of the information, how and where it found that, how it compiled the response to it.
The third question, actually, in terms of the bits and pieces, so as well as how much is it going to cost, where's my data going, is can I trust it? Right, so what kind of response am I getting, and how did it come up with that answer? I mean, in the webinar there, we used something that an image that I put into Stable Diffusion.
Yeah,
and Stable Diffusion is again another one of these
tools. What is Stable Diffusion?
It's another one of these tools that you can use to generate graphic content. So on one of the earlier slides of the presentation, I asked it to create a picture of a black spaniel playing in a river.
Okay.
I click a box that says cinematic, and it comes up with this lovely picture of this very well-groomed spaniel, certainly cleaner than mine, playing in the river, and it's just something that you can use. The other thing you can do is you can give it an existing image and then say, do something with that. So I took a picture. It's actually the one I stuck on my LinkedIn profile,
right,
of me running along. And I took that and shoved it into Stable Diffusion and clicked the box for cinematic. And then all of a sudden, this picture of a very young, athletic would certainly
gentleman
with a lot more hair than I've got and a lot more muscle is generated and
which is your younger self, is it?
Oh no, I don't think so.
To be honest, now I couldn't really tell the difference between the two. No.
Yeah, well, one of them, probably good dating profile material. But
I saw that image. Yeah. There were some interesting, let's call them modifications.
Yeah, some parts of it are really, really clever. And again, the reason I put it in the presentation is I think it makes some really good points. First of all, there's the creative aspect of it, right? It's generated something based on a theme, and you can kind of see where one part of the image has come, right?
Yeah, there's a linkage.
Exactly. It's recognized that that's a runner and put the runner on it. On a track, you know, rather than it being some other kind of event. It's done some things with some of the background images, like there's a bit of blue in the back, and it's assumed that that's another runner, and it's created those other pieces. But then it's also, it's changed the logos on the shorts and the shirt. So it's Adidas and Nike on the newly created image, which it wasn't on the original.
And were you wearing those?
I wasn't wearing those at the time, right? So what's interesting there is, coming back to the point we were around about trust, what you want to understand is why it's made those decisions.
Yeah, what's why it's
actually influenced those pieces. Yeah. So you can only assume that some of the underlying training data said these are pictures of runners and lots of them were wearing Nike and lots of them were wearing Adidas, which sure, you know, fair enough, you know. Yeah. And actually, depending on your use case, that may be perfectly okay. It's, you know, you want to make it look realistic and having that kind of content in there adds to the value. So as long as you understand where the data is coming from and how it's making those decisions, then I think that's, you know, all well and good.
So just building on that in terms of, I suppose, provenance of information. I know we use some tools within Google, but what about for assisting with marketing and our go-to-market activities? Stephen, do you want to just talk a little bit about a couple of the tools that we use? I mean, we talk about plexing these days. It seems to be the trend for one of the particular tools.
Yeah, I think... it's interesting. I wrote a blog article with some assistance from Perplexity, I think it was, just comparing four different tools. Mm-hmm. I looked at ChatGPT, Claude, Copilot, and Perplexity, and asked them all the four same questions.
Right.
This goes back to your prompt engineering a bit.
Yeah.
Asking for more detail for each one. And then I've compared the answers for the four different tools.
Were they the same?
No, they weren't. In fact, there was one answer that was blatantly wrong.
Right, so Neil's point around hallucination.
Hallucination, certainly. But going back to your point about the tools that we use, we mentioned Perplexity.
That's plexing,
yeah. So I use that a lot for almost like a replacement search engine, or an additional search engine.
Yeah. But do you use it every day?
Pretty much so, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So if I need an idea for social media content, for example, I want to write a series of social media posts about an AI webinar, for example.
Yeah.
And it'll give me some subject matters. It'll give me some content.
Mm.
Now, I wouldn't go and paste that straight into our social media tool.
No.
I need to make it more relevant to Deeper Than Blue.
Yes. Yeah.
But it gets you past the blank stage.
Yeah. Yeah. Looking at an empty screen going, I need six social media posts. Sometimes when you're up against it, when your boss is breathing down your neck, you need some answers quick, and it's a great way to get started.
Yeah, it's a great tool, I must admit. It's one of my favourites.
But there are other things like, so Claude is great for creative writing. It feels a lot more creative than Perplexity. Perplexity seems fact based.
Right.
This is from my opinion.
Yeah.
But then you wouldn't go and use those for image generation.
No.
So you mentioned Stable Diffusion. Mm. I use the one Firefly, I think it is, built into Adobe to create images for web posts, web articles.
Yeah, it's interesting because that article you referred to, was it The Devil's in the Detail?
That's the one, yeah.
So I know that you created an image for that, similar to how Neil described using Stable Diffusion. Do you want to just walk people through how you did that and the amount of time that saved?
Yeah, so I'm not a particularly creative person, not a particularly artistic person. Mm. So I wanted to, at the same time as demonstrating AI, because the article was about AI after yes. all,
yeah.
I wanted to create an image that reflected that. But I also wanted it to be... wanted it to fit into our brand. Hmm. So we've got a brand style
okay.
of image. So I created a prompt saying I knew the article was going to be called The Devil in Detail, so I wanted a devilish kind of character in a data like world. And so I put the prompt in along those lines. I gave it a sample image
yeah.
of typical images that we would use on our website. And within 30 seconds, it presented me with three options.
Yeah,
it's a very rapid thing. Now, I don't think this should replace the creativity, the artists, but when times... when you're against it in time.
Well, in the old days, you probably had to go to the clipped image repository, search through those things, try and find something that fit the bill,
yeah.
make the money for the royalties to yeah. actually generate that in. So,
but everybody else would be using the same image, right?
Yeah. Same image.
Or you were using a creative agency.
Yeah.
And fantastic skills, but... You'll be...
Well, time didn't permit on this.
No.
I think that's the important thing.
Yeah.
The one you touched on, we're never suggesting that we're going to replace the creativity that a designer has. Mm. But actually, not all requirements need that level of creativity or can afford the time to do that, can they? You know, just the pressure of getting something out into the market.
Yeah. Well, I think the point of it is that you have to pick the appropriate tool for the job you want it to do. So Firefly and Adobe, brilliant for the graphics, the artistic side of things. Perplexity, great for search. Claude, creativity in terms of content writing. So it's horses for courses.
Yeah, I was just about to say the same thing. Yeah, it is horses for courses, isn't it?
In terms of those, you know, quote-unquote, Claude again mentioned those pieces. Something else that we cover off in the first webinar there was about how you compare large language models and how you actually learn. And again, your article there, you talked about Devil in the Detail article. There's a couple of resources. The LMSIS chatbot arena was one of the things that we referred to. There are resources online where you can go and compare, do a very similar thing that you did, actually, to put a prompt in against multiple LLMs and see how they perform. And then we talked about, you know, some of the terminology that you used there. We mentioned, you know, the size of the model and the number of parameters that things were trained on. But also something you'll hear is people talking about context windows.
Yes.
Some of them are absolutely massive. You know, some of the more recent models, the bigger models, can hold, you know, hours and hours of video in terms of their ability to present. But in terms of what that means, what context window means, a nice way to think about it is it's almost like working memory. How much you can hold in your memory at any one point in time. So if you were creating a new document, how many pages of the previous document could the model hold in its memory at that yes. time to make sure that the new bit that's being created is consistent with all of those components? You know, how much can it do? So, again, in some cases, that doesn't have to be particularly big. In others, if you're doing some kind of creative pieces, then that might actually be quite broad. So, yeah, again, go back and have a look at some of those people. We shared some resources in there in terms of places to go and compare models. But some of those as well come down to some of the there are a number of performance measures and metrics that are now used in order to compare one model to another. Beware again that vendors will generally be quite selective in terms of the ones that they put in place and also in terms of the models that they compare themselves against. But we are getting to the point now where these things
are independence to that.
So you can actually start to look at some of those measures and some of those metrics and see whether or not they are more appropriate for a particular use case.
So we touched on earlier, some of these models are multi-level, therefore they can deal with media.
Yeah.
But some models don't. So that's an example of the difference of how a model may or may not perform in terms of black and white. It could do imaging video, but others can't.
You won't be able to do multi-language support or if you put some kind of translation type app in place.
Then, so not all models are really
multi-language. No, not all of them will do that. And again, some of them won't have been trained on those pieces as well with that in mind. So it's got to be quite selective there in terms of how those things function.
Where am I going to look if beyond the models that the major vendors, IBM, Google, Microsoft, OpenAI, feel like there's somebody out there they're the ones that we know have platforms. So this might be introducing something new here, but they on those platforms, they've got many different models available.
Mm.
Where else would I go and look to find a model that might fit?
If you want to look at, you could go to Hugging Face.
Hugging Face, yeah.
As a starting point for large language models, and actually that's quite a good place to go to look for things that are generally sitting in the open source space. It's quite a nice piece to go. Just coming back to the vendors piece, I think something that's worth bearing in mind is that quite often the vendors in question are looking to use AI and their AI offerings as a way of complementing their core offering or bringing people towards that. So if you look at Microsoft, for instance, I think it's a good example.
Okay.
They've got their Copilot capability, which you can use in the same way as ChatGPT with a little agent chat capability. But actually, increasingly, what they're doing is rolling that capability into Office and Office 365.
Yeah.
So
embedding it.
Yeah. So
Google's the same with Workspace and Gemini.
Yeah. So again, good example really that Workspace from Google point of view, it's adding additional capability to attract more users into that sort of space, and it makes that capability a lot more sticky.
And do you think people are more productive with those tools?
Well, definitely. I mean, anecdotally, you see lots of and I guess just looking at the Copilot piece from Microsoft stuff. Their whole piece is that it's AI for every day.
Mm.
So it's about trimming 5 minutes here and there, 20 seconds here and there. The trouble with that is, it's quite difficult to quantify that at the end of this. It's not a bottom line benefit, is it? It's not going straight on your profit and loss. It's making people more productive, but it's really important, I think, especially in the early days of this stuff, is that you do get in and make every effort to try and measure the value you're getting from that.
And these are typically £20 to £30 subscriptions per person to get to an enterprise discount.
Exactly.
So in an organisation of 1,000 or 10,000 people, everybody?
Well, that's you could do. You could just throw it,
throw it over the wall.
You could throw it on the wall and let everybody have a play with it and see whether or not you can identify some really nice use cases.
What's the end of year one,
you'll find that a large percentage of people don't use it for anything, and you're still paying £30 a month for those folks.
For a thousand people,
or X many thousand people. You'll have some small pockets of evangelists who are really using it for almost everything.
Yeah.
And you'll have a lot of people who like it and it's adding feel that it's making them more productive.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, again, is that actually showing up on your bottom line? So you could do that. Absolutely, you could do it. But a better approach.
What would we suggest as an approach for that office based collaborative desktop users?
I think that that certainly in terms of familiarizing core groups of individuals with what's possible and what AI can deliver. then
an education aspect,
then actually having a cross-section of people who can put those things to use in, is useful. But I think you should probably be trying to look at specific use cases. Keep the scope small. So if you are just going to give it to everybody, give it to one department. Give it to a small group of people who you can then keep your eye on in terms of how those things are being used, and actually share the knowledge and the learnings from those pieces, and try and identify what specific aspects of that use is are actually creating the value.
Yeah.
It could be, for instance, that you start using, let's say, Copilot or Gemini in workplace, or in order to solve a specific problem, only to realise that there are other ways to go.
Yeah. You know, so what are the other ways? I mean, we touched there in terms of office and desktop productivity for employees.
Yeah.
But without being rude, that's just one part of where generative AI can play a role. There's a larger role for it, isn't it? I mean, I mentioned earlier platforms like Vertex, IBM Watson X, Microsoft have got their Azure AI platform.
Yeah.
How do they figure in terms of taking people to a different level with AI?
I think just before we kind of move on to those, I think one of the real benefits of the Copilot approach and the Gemini for workspace approach is that it does give you an opportunity to bring AI capability back into people's everyday workspace.
Okay.
So you do have that additional value, but it could be that it's not just the stuff that comes out of the box. It could be that actually what you want to do is to enhance those things with things like Studio or additional development that maybe link back into some of your enterprise systems and actually allow you to put in place complementary capabilities.
So now we're starting to head in the direction of building bespoke AI, generative AI applications to some degree.
Yeah, bespoke is probably a little bit strong.
Right.
I'm saying you can probably dip your toe in the water with things that are kind of low code, that are quite easy adapters. So out of the box, there may be the ability to summarize your email or respond to those capabilities or respond to an email using a standard flavor. But then you might have an enhancement that allows you to go and look at your back-end enterprise data and retrieve information that's relative to the content of the email. So I've just had a complaint from a customer. Let's go and retrieve some information that's pertinent to the last order they placed or their order history or some other components like that. So in order to put that in place, you don't necessarily have to get into anything bespoke, but you might need to trigger a few adapters or plug in some additional pieces. Okay. So we kind of get into those. But however, as you get more specific, you might identify certain areas that are unique to your business and your processes. And in order to get that kind of value, we're moving well away from what Microsoft thought was great for everybody.
Yeah.
To something that you've recognised is really valuable to you.
It's not off the shelf.
It's not off the shelf, yeah.
It's not a SaaS
no.
package that you can sign up to or subscribe to for a period of time.
It's just identifying where you're going to get that value and then how you go about implementing it.
Yeah.
And it could be that you can get all of that value for a lot less than it would cost you to give a subscription service to everybody in your organisation.
Sure, sure.
So I think there's a bit of a journey to go on there. So I think as a starting point, some of those tools that are either chat-based and you can just give them to people and say, here's some various, here's a nice way of working for this, or you can use it for this particular process, is nice and gets you moving and certainly will give you some productivity pieces.
It's an introduction.
It's an introduction. And
but you can't take a box that says we're doing AI
completed. We've given it to everybody, so then we've done it. Yeah. What you actually want to do is to say, what specific value are we getting from these things? And I think, if you do decide to just throw it over the wall and give it to everybody, go back quickly and see how many people are actually using it and whether you're still getting it.
Yeah, definitely 12 months.
Still need 12 months. It's an expensive business to do that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that seems like an appropriate place to leave it.
Okay.
For now, I think we can dig deeper into specific use cases.
Yeah.
We'll certainly be doing that on the webinars.
Yeah.
And that should give us plenty of material for future podcasts.
Okay.
Well, thanks for today, Neil. Thanks
Thank you.
For joining in with us on this. Okay. We appreciate it.
Interesting as ever.
Yeah, I think what it's done is hopefully given people materials on how to get that initial learning in place. As you said, if you step through future webinars, podcasts, it'll help accelerate people on their AI journey.
Yeah,
I think some of the content we referred to. I don't know if you're putting those or including some of those in this. But again, I'd recommend the first webinar in the series to people. Go back and have a look, and we get into some additional use cases and get into some additional details.
Yeah, there's definitely some value, isn't there? Yeah. That we do go into what we refer to as market, sales, service, and expert systems, and demonstrate examples of those, don't we?
Yeah, and there's also some examples around cost comparisons and things as well.
It's true. So yeah. There's a lot more depth, isn't there, than what we're able to go into today.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks, guys.
Okay. Thank you. Plenty of information.
All right, thank you.
All right.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard, send them to info@deeperthanblue.co.uk. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Bye for now.